Ambassador College and the Worldwide Church of God presents Gunnar Ted Armstrong. All literature offered on this program will be sent free of cost to anyone requesting it.
He may not have ants in the pouch, but he certainly got them on his pants and elsewhere in his anatomy. He scratches feverishly. Australia is a land of odd animals. The next half hour, we're going to show you a cross-section of some of the most unbelievable creatures on the face of the earth. And their very existence poses questions for the theory of evolution. We've all heard at least a little bit about some of the animal oddities of the land down under, Australia. But when you think of kangaroos, you think usually of only one kind of kangaroos. But did you know there are actually 59 kinds of kangaroos in Australia? Some of these strange creatures do pose serious questions for the theory of evolution we're going to see in this program. You know, you think of the national anthem of Australia, Waltzing Matilda. Some people think that was even named after a kangaroo. It wasn't really, to my knowledge, but you do think of the song, Tie Me Kangaroo Down, Sport. But there are very, very many assorted odd and bizarre animal forms in the land down under. Meet the tiny Rufus kangaroo. The speedy Potteroo. And the swimming quokka, the flightless emu, the old patchwork platypus, as he's called by evolutionists, Macquarie Island penguins, the lungfish that breathes like a human, the long-tongued echidna, the numbat, last and cuddliest, the koala bear concludes the group. Did you know the koala is not really a bear? He is rather a member of the family Marsupialia. In this program, we want to study the uniqueness of some of these animals. For example, marsupial means animals whose young are kept in a bag or a pouch of skin on the underside of the female for some time after birth. The young are always born in an embryonic state and then develop in the pouch. Australia is the home of most of the world's marsupials. Some of these animals are highly restricted and specialized in their diet. For instance, the koala bear is limited to eating the leaves of about 12 varieties of the eucalyptus tree. But most of all, koalas are cute and cuddly. That is, if you can keep one awake long enough, like this one. Now, here's one that seems to be very alert. At least he's scratching, so that's alert for a koala. Oops, maybe we were wrong about that. Well, I've got to rest up for my next nap. Koalas would like to spend every waking hour in sleep, if that makes sense. Australia has a small furry animal that is rarely even seen by Australians, which is called the numbat. That's a real name. You've heard of dingbats, wombats, and so on. Well, this is the numbat. It lives only in a narrow strip of land on the southwest corner of the continent. It feeds exclusively on termites, and mainly on a particular variety, which is hard to pronounce, called Coptyrnes or something like that. Don't quote me. The gentle numbat has no means of defense except running away. Numbats have a small body, about 9 1/2 inches long, if you include the tail, perhaps 17 inches overall. The fly on this one's leg will give you an idea of your size, and if you can see the germ on the fly's leg, you get an even better idea. A keen sense of smell is probably the sole means of locating food. He has to strengthen his legs and claws to tear open rods and expose the termites. Driven by a voracious appetite, he's not the quietest eater there is in the world. But with an area fairly well covered with hollow logs, fallen trees, flowering bush, and live trees or termites of abundance, it cannot survive in cold areas. Sensing danger, the numbat runs to a hollow log. A carpet snake approaches the log where the numbat is hiding. So the numbat waits. And then hauls it out of there. Now, the numbat is a marsupial, just like the American opossum. Typically, the young of all marsupials are born in an embryonic state. They're not really even totally developed. They then develop for several months, attached firmly to the mother's mammary gland. The numbat is the only marsupial without a pouch. A curtain of stiff hairs protects the growing young. Incredibly tiny, these newborn numbats are the size of a grain of wheat. They weigh 1/200th of an ounce. In a few weeks, they grow hair. The ears become visible. Yet they're only the size of a human's little fingernail. Growth is agonizingly slow during the first 4 months of attachment to the mother. Yet only 1 month later, the youngsters have grown to the size of this one you see climbing on his mother's back. But the really interesting thing in all this is not, aren't these magnificent animals, or aren't these strange-looking creatures, or aren't they weird, or my, look at that. But why are they the way they are? How did such cycles of life, the development of a little embryonic beginning the size of a grain of wheat in a mother's pouch and firmly attached to a mammary gland, and then gradually completing the rest of this birth stage outside of the womb. How did it get started originally? You know, evolution says that we are the product, the end result, of all the processes in nature that evolution points to, such as the almost infinite variety within certain species, the adaptability to certain environmental stimuli. They talk about fruit flies and the moths of the industrial areas of England. They cite the many cases of similarity in a bat's wing, or perhaps the fin of a whale or the hand of a man. They look at comparative embryology, comparative anatomy. They have so many things that seem to be arguments that show how we might be the end product of what is called evolution, which is a way of explaining creation without a creator. Orderliness, law, all from randomness and happenstance. Human life from blind chance. I say that some of these strange creatures of Australia, with their symbiotic interdependency on each other, with their strange and unique characteristics, pose tremendous headaches and questions for theorists in evolution who would like to propose that you and I are the products of blind chance. Instead of created human beings with fantastic destiny, we ought to be busily discovering. Why do some of these little characters have to feed on just certain kinds of food? And why would a koala bear, for example, be able only to eat the leaf of eucalyptus-type trees? Why do some of them act the way they do? Are marsupials really some type of free mammal, a kind of an inferior, strange beast that got cut off from the rest of the world as they were changing into mammals but never quite finished? Evolution would like us to think that some of these creatures are a kind of a part this, part that, but they really didn't develop as well as other creatures. But they're fantastically developed. They do perfectly what they do in their protective mechanisms, in their food-getting habits, in their birth cycles. All that they do is peculiarly and perfectly adapted to the exact environment where you find them. This brochure, called The Whale of a Tale or The Dilemma of Dolphin and Duckbill, takes issue with some of these questions of evolution. Now, you can see that we are talking primarily about the toothed whales and dolphins. We did a program on that not long ago, and our cameramen went out to SeaWorld, I think to Marine Land in Southern California here in Los Angeles. SeaWorld is down in San Diego. And we had some fantastic film. Here's a picture of the sequences of the birth of a dolphin that show how, in this particular instance, unlike all other mammals that have to be born head first, the dolphins have to be born tail first, with all the difficulty that is for the mother, because the blowhole is on the back of the head, and that's got to come out last. It's a fantastic question, too. And by the way, the color photography here is really fantastic in these brochures. But back here toward the end, you see this cartoon about the patchwork platypus. We're going to show you real film. We've already shown you a short sequence of in this program that is called A Patchwork Creature, because evolutionists don't know where to put them.
From the tiny insects living all about us to the giants that swim the oceans, the world of nature abounds in strange and fantastic creatures. The Ambassador College publication, A Whale of a Tale, challenges you to investigate the problems posed by some of the least understood of all animals, the whales and dolphins. Did these ocean-going mammals return to the sea after living on land? Is there a fossil record that proves this evolutionary change? Also covered in this brochure, the Australian duck-billed platypus. Why does this patchwork creature cause so many problems for those trying to explain its origin? Intriguing and colorfully illustrated, this challenging brochure, A Whale of a Tale, will interest the entire family. Your copy of A Whale of a Tale is free of charge. Write to Ambassador College, Box 345, GPO Sydney. Please enclose a postage stamp to assist with mailing.
School children have written in and told us that they have gotten excellent grades, as long as they don't take issue with evolution, I suppose, with some of their professors in school by doing research projects on this type of material. It's very interesting for young and old alike. Nearly everyone has watched at one time or another a spider weaving a web or a nest building project of a sparrow or a robin outside your window in a tree. We're familiar with all types of nests that creatures use, but you know, this business of laying eggs, of incubating, producing babies of birds, has one unique exception in the entirety of the fowl world. And that's a strange bird down in Australia that's called Megapode, or Bigfoot, or more properly, a Mallee fowl. It goes through a complicated process to hatch its young, which is unbelievable, and I want you to watch. Instead of simply building a nest, it builds a giant, elaborate incubator out of sand, or in the case of Indonesia, out of rotting, fermenting vegetation. And instead of using its body for heat, it has this elaborate method, including even probing with its tongue like a thermometer to find out the exact temperature, which is about 92 degrees Fahrenheit. It has to continue there to keep its eggs warm. And so the bird deposits the eggs in the ground and then spends its next weeks frantically trying to keep those eggs from either dying because of extreme heat or dying because of extreme cold. Scientists can't decide whether this rare bird is degenerate, whether it's over-specialized, or whether it's primitive. In fact, some even wonder whether it's a bird. Well, take a look for yourself at the unusual egg-hatching cycle of this Australian Mallee fowl. Beginning in June and on through August, Australia is winter months, remember, the Mallee fowl digs a hole about 15 feet wide by 4 feet deep in loose, sandy soil. This mound is to house and hatch the family brood. After they deposit some leaves, large sticks, and twig litter, they cover it with sand until the material is heaped well above the soil level. This vegetable matter, then, below the mound, will decay. It ferments, and that gives off heat, and that helps hatch the egg. Mallees thrive and build their mounds throughout wide areas of Australia. Taking a bit of sand in his beak, the male bird tests the temperature constantly as the vegetable matter decays and the mound temperature rises. By early September, the nest temperature has reached about 92 degrees Fahrenheit. The male bird then opens the mound. The female takes over briefly and makes final nest preparation in the vegetable matter. She lays eggs that weigh 1/2 pound each. That's 1/7 of her own body weight. Returning periodically, she may lay up to 30 eggs in a 5-month period. The male examines the egg to make sure it's all right, and then carefully covers it. He maintains a nearly exact 92 degrees for 7 long months. Shown at the end of August, this is an early springtime mound. Twigs, leaves, and sticks have already started fermenting below the egg chamber to heat it. Frequent testing tells the male bird he's got to dissipate the extra heat coming from below. So he visits the mound every day at dawn before sunup while it's yet cool. He opens the mound and tests the temperature by taking a bit of sand in his beak. And it's believed the actual test is made with his tongue. He then quickly refills the mound with cool sand. The summer mound is dome-shaped. Its greater depth protects against extra heat from the sun above. Therefore, the mound has to be higher in the center. Remember, the earlier mound was getting extra heat from below. The best shape for releasing extra heat from below is the flatter springtime mound. Again, the male bird visits daily at dawn. The dome-shaped summer mound is a very effective insulator, but testing reveals that additional cooling is still needed. After opening the mound, he thoroughly mixes in cool sand and rebuilds his insulating dome over the egg chamber. The purpose of the autumn mound is different. It's to keep the heat in, not out. The insulating dome is still a very good shape, but the mound must be reheated every day. So each morning he reshapes it into a broad saucer. This is done only when the sun is well up and shining. 2 to 3 inches of sand are left to cover the eggs. As the sun heats the exposed sand, small quantities are replaced continually throughout the day until the mound is reheated and rebuilt. Remember, the summer mound was to keep the sun's heat out, and the spring mound dissipated heat from below. But the autumn mound recaptures and stores heat as it is reshaped each day. The mallee fowl is normally very shy, but this one is so intent on maintaining an exact temperature that his instinct takes over and he loses all fear of man. Unbelievable film, isn't it? To look at these crazy birds, you would think, going to those elaborate methods when they could just simply lay their eggs and sit on them like any other self-respecting bird would, you think, figure out to do. And yet that unique kind of a bird goes through all that elaborate covering and uncovering. They've got to figure that temperature. And when you talk about rotting vegetation up in Indonesia, the problems are even more critical. It's quite a head-scratching problem for evolutionists to tell you exactly how that could have evolved. Because you see the enormous difficulties of the very first time it was ever done, and whether or not it had to be successful so that mallee fowl could survive, well, that's the type of question we go into in this brochure, A Whale of a Tale, which I hope that you will write for, because it asks about the very first migration. It talks about the very first birth of a dolphin, the very first one of these creatures, and how they possibly could have survived. I believe there is a creator God who is originator, who is author, who is designer, who is life giver, who is the creator of his creation, who presently sustains that creation. And I'm not talking about a God that is the kind of a great old father figure way off somewhere in the vagueness of human minds, where you can go out in a field of daisies and say, God made this, or whether you say, God made the sun, and you can appreciate God by going out and looking at nature. That's not the kind of God I'm talking about. I'm talking about the God of the Bible, the God who was revealed by Jesus Christ of Nazareth in the New Testament, a God with a great purpose in human life. And in the Bible, in the first chapter of the book of Romans, it talks about how we may know about his eternal Godhead, his divinity, his plan, and his purpose by looking at the things which are made. When I look at creation then, I look at strange creatures and instinct acting on little birds and all these creatures, I'm looking at a fantastic and a marvelous mind that thought it out, designed it, created it, presently sustains it, put it all in motion. And I have taken exception over many, many years teaching classes, doing hundreds of radio broadcasts and telecasts about the theory of evolution, because I believe it is an anti-God, atheistic theory which has done a great deal of damage to cloud people's minds at a fact of the existence of a creator God. Well, are some of these animals, according to evolutionists, primitive? Are they only partially developed? The marsupials are perfectly designed for the life they themselves live in Australia. And the very familiar kangaroo illustrates this point. The key advantage they have over other herbivores, such as cattle and sheep, is convenience and ease of birth. The offspring of the kangaroo is only an inch long at birth. It weighs about 2 ounces, and it's blind. It's only an embryo, almost totally undeveloped. The first sign birth is imminent comes when the female begins to clean her pouch. At the actual time of delivery, she passes her tail forward between her hind legs and carries her body weight forward on the base of her tail. As soon as the little tiny baby, if it can be called that, it's really an embryo, is born, it begins an amazing journey, totally unaided, knowing exactly where to go, yet without eyes, to the safety and life of its mother's pouch. Remember, this tiny little life is blind. It has no real developed hind legs. It's just a little quavering muscle, as it were, but it still finds its way. And once there, it attaches its mouth to one of the mother's mammary glands, which then expands in his mouth, assuring permanent attachment. He is then forcibly fed while growing in this condition for several months. A research team, for example, found recently that 75% of the red kangaroo females were carrying babies in their pouches. 60 to 70% of these mothers also still had an embryo in the uterus. Still another 20% were suckling youngsters who had left the pouch. This means that a great number of females had one baby in the pouch, another in the uterus, and a third, a youngster was not quite independent yet, outside the pouch. During a time of drought, 75% of the newly independent die, but because the embryos are waiting in hibernation, the females can be ready to give birth again within 4 weeks if the pouch is vacated. So the cycle goes on endlessly and they find a method of survival. Sheep suffering from drought also lose 75% or more of their newborn lambs. But the ewes won't give birth again in anything like 4 weeks. The female won't generally bear another young one for about a year. Meanwhile, the marsupials busily replenish themselves in spite of extreme dryness.
Subscription to the Australian edition of the monthly magazine Plain Truth, write to Ambassador College, Box 345, GPO Sydney. Please enclose a postage stamp to assist with mailing.
We are continually striving to make this publication exactly what the title says, Plain Truth. It's plain spoken, straight from the shoulder, plain talk, just like you get on the daily World Tomorrow radio programs and on these telecasts. And every single issue, we have not only the writers of our own staff from around the world contributing, as you can see here in the issue we showed you, some of these features, the war that won't get away, won't get up and leave, won't go away over in Indochina, New Era Dawns for Suez Canal, Bureau reports from around the world, The Incredible Human Potential, a series now, my father's new book, is showing the whole purpose of our life here on this earth, Food and Population War, my column, but many other features. We have Art Buchwald's column, political cartoons, and others in every single number of The Plain Truth. The creatures in Australia are not only inside the land mass of Australia. The Great Barrier Reef and the seas around Australia also abound with very strange and fascinating creatures that present absolutely unanswerable problems for evolution. The Great Barrier Reef, 80,000 square miles of living coral, stands out as one of the wonders of the world. It teems with every type of sea life, including the sea turtle. At night, the mother turtle climbs out of the sand to dig a foot-deep depression for her 250-pound bulk. Now she must dig the actual egg chamber. Working her rear flippers like hands, she scoops and scoops until they reach only air. Then she backs over the chamber and begins laying eggs. At first, only one or two eggs at a time. Later, in clutches of four or six until about 110 eggs are deposited. She immediately covers the eggs with sand and moves off about 5 yards to dig a false nest to fool predators. Finally, she pushes slowly and deliberately back to sea, but will return 5 more times during the summer at 15-day intervals to complete her egg-laying cycle. Her work of reproduction finished, she swims the 1,000 miles back to her feeding grounds where she will stay for 3 years before returning to this exact same place to repeat the egg-laying cycle. The tiny baby turtle is very weak at birth. When it has broken the shell, it lies at rest for 2 days, absorbing its umbilicus. With new strength gained, it pushes up through the sand to the surface. If it is daylight, the turtles lie quietly until nightfall. They know that they should do this, hiding from birds or other predators. Then, with the help of darkness, they scramble over one another in their rush to the open sea. Only 1 in 1,000 of the babies will live to mate in 7 years, and as a full-grown adult, repeat this cycle. Fantastic and strange creatures, aren't they? But really, we've saved the most bizarre of all for last, at least according to evolutionists. You're about to see footage of what scientists and evolutionists call a living fossil. It's called a patchwork mammal that time forgot. Take a close look at Australia's duck-billed platypus. He appears to be made up of odds and ends left over from the creation, half reptile, half bird, and half mammal. Scientists say his combination of a reptilian shoulder girdle, a poisonous spur on one hind leg, retractable webbed feet, laying of eggs, and feeding the young milk that drips from enlarged pores is incredible, unbelievable, and really beyond reason. Most Australian mammals were named by the Aboriginals, but the platypus comes from the Greek and simply means broadly webbed feet. An average platypus weighs about 4.5 pounds, is 22 inches long from the tip of his bill to the end of his beaver-like tail. Now, the bill of a platypus, though it looks like a duck's, is really different. It has a soft, leathery sheath that looks almost as though it were pushed out of his nose as an afterthought. You have to look very hard to find the ears. They're directly behind his eyes. Try to imagine how even one part of that platypus could possibly have evolved, because scientist has no place to fit this strange creature in its scheme of various family trees in orderly and logical sequence of development over aeons and aeons of time. Really, when you look at the duck-billed platypus and all the other creatures of the land down under, there and other places around the world, and you realize science is still discovering strange fish and insects that they never knew existed before. And you have to ask, how could this possibly have evolved? Well, that's what this brochure, A Whale of a Tale, does. How could this possibly have occurred under the process they call evolution? Is creation true or evolution? Write for this brochure and also request the current number of the Plain Truth magazine. The address again in just a moment. Until next time, Gardner Ted Armstrong. Goodbye, friends.
All literature offered on the Gardner Ted Armstrong program is sent free upon request. For your free copy of A Whale of a Tale booklet and your subscription to the monthly magazine, Plain Truth, write to Ambassador College, Box 345, GPO, Sydney. Please enclose a postage stamp to assist with mailing. Be sure to watch Gardner Ted Armstrong again next week at this time. Brought to you by Ambassador College and the Worldwide Church of God.